Welcome to Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party, and I'm sitting here with my old pal Bill Kirchen, who I know from, 1985, I think.
That's what I'm thinking, 40 years, I think. It's close to 40 years.
Amazing. All right, and you played on my first album, which was a thrill. But we're going to talk to Bill about his start in music, were you born in Ann Arbor?
No, I was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Okay. I was there by the time I was 6 months old.
So. Yeah, that's like me. And I was born in New Haven, Connecticut.
Right.
And I was gone to L.A. by 6 months.
Neither one of us can claim.
But yeah, I can't really claim. Yeah.
I drove right by it two days ago.
So did your parents move straight to Michigan?
They were briefly in Connecticut. They'd met other places. My dad was from Montana, my mom from Minnesota, so they met and moved around. They were both teachers, so they'd
go
where the gigs were. My dad ended up with Remington Arms in Stratford. Anyway, so they moved to Ann Arbor, and that's where they stayed the rest of their life.
Okay.
In 1949.
Yeah, wow.
It's right at the beginning of 49, yep.
And so I love your guys' story, man. I mean, about Commander Cody.
There's a lot of stories.
Well, there are a lot of stories, but I'm just saying,
all you
guys were very intelligent, educated people with just whacked out senses of humor.
Right. Yeah. I'll tell you what, Ann Arbor, it's a college town, but it was a really advanced place to grow up as far as the arts and movies and music and stuff. It really, I look back and think, man, I was lucky to just pop up there as a child.
Well, it almost seems like that and Berkeley and Austin, all these places were kind of epicenters of, culture in a lot of ways, in the United States. I remember I hitchhiked to Ann Arbor when I was 17. Yeah, I met Boogie Woogie Red.
Did you go to the Blues Festival?
No, I ended up going to the Blind Pig with Boogie Woogie Red 1972.
Were you on Blind Pig Records?
Later on, way later. Only one album, before they folded. I was.
Oh, they were. Yeah. We were too. I think we did a Commander
Cody album. Right.
Was doing that. Yeah. So yeah, Ann Arbor was cool. I graduated from high school in '65.
Okay.
And so I took a year off before I went to college because I was a year young, and in that time I started a band. There's a bunch of stories about all that, but just to kind of put a little overview of the Cody thing. George Frank, Commander Cody, we finally named him Commander Cody, and John Tishy were frat brothers at the University of Michigan.
He's super smart.
He just stepped down as head of the Mechanical, Aeronautical, and Nuclear Engineering Department at Rensselaer Polytech, which is in Troy, New York. It's a big tech school. It's not MIT, but it's right there with it.
That's incredible.
And he's the rocking professor. He still plays music.
Yeah.
And of course, George has passed on. But anyway, so that was that. So they sort of assembled an oddball. I was a town hippie, and I had a band, the Seventh Seal, which I can tell you about how that started.
Right.
And we were a psychedelic folk rock band.
Well, how old were you at that point?
Well, let's see, I graduated at 16 from high school. I turned 17 right after that. I graduated a year young. And I would have been, 17 when I started the 17th.
Okay. So that was 66?
Yeah, 66, okay. Exactly. Or was it late 60s? Yeah, 66.
Right.
And they saw me playing at a film festival.
You're saying Cody and Tish?
Yeah, it's Cody and Tish saw me. And they don't know. They says, I don't know what he's doing, but he looks cool. We'd play, shit, and then we'd...
And you were a lead guitar player.
Well, I was a guitar player. I'm telling you, I didn't know what I was doing. I played with plastic finger pickers. I had a borrowed Jaguar.
Okay, that's great.
But I made it work. I learned folk guitar first. I learned Mississippi John Hurt and that was the thing about Ann Arbor. There was a folk scene, Coach, would encompass old blues, and there was a couple of guys that I met who were part of the Washington, D.C. scene of the people that had rediscovered John Hurt, for instance.
Now, who was that?
Well, that guy's named Peter Turin. I'm still friends with him today.
Okay.
Dick Spotswood was a big wheel in that world in D.C. As a matter of fact, when I moved there years later, he had a radio show where he played. He'd say, I'm playing these old Mossy 78s.
Wow, okay.
So that was a big scene for me.
Yeah.
And I learned, I got turned on to all that stuff, to John Hurt and John Fahey and Blaine, Sam Firth, whatever that is.
Wow. You know,
and, but all the old guys too.
Yeah.
Skip James. And, yeah. So I went to Newport in 64.
So you saw a lot of people.
I saw Sunhouse, Skip James, John Hurt. You can see me on the back of the Blues at Newport 64. There was two volumes.
Right.
You see from the back of John Hurt's head, he has his little bowler hat, and then you look out in the audience, there's me in the corner at 16.
Wow. That's great.
He's just glad to be there. I was a Dylan fan, too. So there's also on YouTube is the concert that I was sitting right in front of. The stage was about this high. It was Bob Dylan with Pete Seeger sitting on stage and a bunch of other people.
Wow.
And He stood there and sang Mr. Tambourine.
Right.
It still makes, you know, it still just knocks me out.
Yeah.
So anyway, I saw one of the great experiences I had there was, you know, I'm young. I don't know anything. I have a little banjo of my mom's that I brought.
Right.
You know, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm really frail from the Pete Seeger book. But Son House gets up there and Son goes, Son House, he announces that it's something like this. You know, real just super quiet. I couldn't understand what he said.
Right.
And I thought to myself, you know, I'm young. I think, well, this guy's old, and you know, I just won't. I'll just sit through him and throw someone I can understand comes along. You know, I didn't know who Sunhouse was.
Right.
And I later come to think this was a stunt. You know, this was a stage move. But
could have been.
His eyeballs roll right the heck out of his vision, and he hits this big steel guitar. Ding! And he starts singing Death Letter Blues at the top of his lungs. I'm like, the hair goes up on my neck right now.
Yeah, that's great.
So that kind of stuff, that's the kind of stuff I saw.
Yeah.
Robert Pete Wilkins, who was kind of weird, like Skip James.
Right, I know who he is.
And Sleepy John Estes sitting there with a trio, like a jug band. I really like the Western jug band. So, So Hammy Nixon's got a jug, and Yank Rochelle or Rachel playing a man.
Right.
Big old man. And Sleepy John sitting there singing, you know.
That's like heavy stuff, man.
Oh, man.
That's so heavy.
I'm so lucky I got to see all that.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
So lucky.
Yeah, that's stuff that, you know, you're either lucky enough to see it or you just only have the records.
That's right.
And it's a big difference.
And even though I didn't have any reference for that, well, I have a little reference. I've been listening to folk music. So. Mm-hmm. And also, I saw a lot of old-timey guys, and plus the young guys coming up, who I love. I love Jim Queston.
Right.
And, maybe
Jeff Muldaur.
I, matter of fact, I had his first record, and I have a tape of me and my first band. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm like, and I was trying to imitate Jeff Muldaur. I wanted to be Jeff Muldaur when I grew up.
He was such a great guitar player, too.
He was
well
great.
A singer, yeah.
And I also saw, I remember seeing John Hammond back in those days. And I saw Kernery and Glover.
Okay, wow, you saw everybody pretty much.
Guys. Yeah, they were great. And those guys were at Newport, Kernery and Glover.
Right.
So it was cool.
Now, did you go to the Blues Festival in Arizona?
I was gone already. I'd gone out to California.
Didn't Bruce Barlow?
Yes, he
did. He played, right?
Yeah.
Your
the guy
bass
that
player?
Ended up being my bass player,
right.
Who I will play with out in California in a couple of months.
And he played with Magic Sammy.
That's right. He joined Magic Sammy's band. He'd been on the road kind of as a roadie for Luther Allison, I believe.
Really?
Yeah, or something. I don't remember how this exactly worked, but he met those guys. He's from Oxnard.
Wow.
And he actually, before that,
how do you end up in Ann Arbor? Did you meet him in
San
Francisco?
He was on the road.
Okay.
He didn't live in Ann Arbor. As a matter of fact, Bruce never lived in Ann Arbor, to my knowledge. But what he did, he was from California.
Right.
He met these guys out there.
So he met him in San Francisco.
Maybe.
Yeah.
All I know is that he was offered the job playing bass with Littlefield, but he turned him down because we offered him a job too, and we had a record deal with Littlefield, so he went
right.
But
wow.
This would have been before that he played with Sam, and it was Bruce Barlow, Sam Lay on drums,
right.
And Magic Sam.
Lay. Yeah, trio. And they sound killer. Those recordings
those
are just
great.
Amazing.
Bruce is wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful. So that's that era. And.
And did you guys meet Lance Dickerson, your drummer, in Ann Arbor or California?
Ann Arbor, because he had a band called Billy C and the Sunshine.
Okay, so and him and Billy
him
C.
Him and Billy C played together. Farlow they were both from Livonia, yeah. Oh, okay. Outside of Ann Arbor, they weren't in Ann Arbor.
All right. Guys. Now, did they have a band together, though?
Yeah, they had it, yeah. Billy C. and the Sunshine. Lance played with them.
Was that a blues band?
It was a flat-out blues band. Billy right. C. led it and played harp. And right. Strictly right. blues. And, of course, Billy C. went on later to play with Sam Lay.
Right. I knew he played with yep. Sam. Yeah.
And
Lance played with
Musselwhite. That's right.
Before you guys, right?
That's, I think so. Yeah. I'm pretty much sure, yeah.
Right.
And then there was a Blues All-Star Tour out in California. And back in the 60s, it's late 60s, but that was about 69 maybe.
Right.
And somehow those guys went to see him, and I don't know who all was on that tour, but I wasn't there, but they met Bruce there.
Okay.
And that's how that, and then somehow that's how that came about 69 with the show.
So did you guys all kind of conglomerate in California or in
Ann Arbor? No, but the band started in Ann Arbor, but without Lance, without Bruce.
Okay.
And so it was without me, a lot of, but Billy C. joined in Ann Arbor because Billy C. Okay. had played at a blues club, a really African-American blues club in Ann Arbor called Flint's Club, and he played there with Billy C. So okay. those guys saw this blues guy, this hillbilly from Alabama who played blues. They saw this hippie, me.
Right.
And then later they ran into Andy Stein on the street, I think. They were walking, you know, Andy was walking by with his fiddle case, and he always looked kind of eccentric.
So in other words, cardigans. Like-minded so people find yeah, like-minded
right,
people.
Right, even they look completely different. Yeah. So it was a pretty cool amalgamation. We had a sax player too named Hugh. Gosh, I can't think of his last name. I know him pretty well. He played sax for us for a while. So it was an art band, and we had dancing girls and girls in scanty outfits doing jumping jacks, and then I remember we played in one gig. We played a dental school ball or something, and. Commander's brother Chris Frain, who was the artist, you know, the wild-eyed artist who did the album covers, right. He started showing videos of dental extractions on the album. So it was those days. It was the 60s. It was Marino.
And you guys did one of the first videos too, didn't you?
Wasn't we did it. Well, it was early on in MTV.
The one at the burger joint on Lakeshore.
That's right.
Dude, right.
TikTok. I
think it was called something else. I can't remember what it's called, but yeah, I know exactly. It's still there.
Is it? Wow.
Yeah, it's the drive-in with the big, he had like arches, as I recall.
Maybe, yeah. It was called, the song was Two Triple Cheese Side Over the Fries. It was shot in this diner. You can still see it online. It's a great video.
It's still there.
And it had a lot of Chris Frain's hand stop action automation he'd done before.
It's a great video.
It's really good. And it was kind of nice because back in those days, MTV had mostly,
right, punk really, rockers punk and rock, stuff. Really
self-involved. Yeah. No sense of humor. So this was funny.
It's still a great video to watch, man. So I remember you turned me on to the book Star Maker Machinery, which was totally about the Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airmen, and that was that from the very start of your guys' career?
No,
was that kind of midway?
It was from like our fourth album, and we moved to. Well, we were on a major label, Paramount, at the time, but then we ended on Warner Brothers, which seemed to us to be a step up, and it certainly was, because our first album we first signed in 71, had a hit on the first album in 72, but this would have been more like 74, I think, or 5.
Right.
And also, it was one of these things like, yes, 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 no, typical record.
It's really one of the best books about the record business.
It's Fly on the Wall.
It's such a great book. It's such a great book. And if you go online and try to buy it,
you can't.
It's like $2,000.
I gotta go home and sell my copy. I'll be right back. I recommend
any of you rich people to go out there and buy that book, because it is a must.
Yeah, it's a great book. Jeff Stokes was a reporter for the Village Voice.
Oh, was he really?
Somehow he got tagged to do the thing.
Yeah.
But it also, a friend of mine read it, and it's funny because it's really engaging. And he knew us very well, and he knew that this stardom that looked imminent at one point in the book had not happened.
Right.
You know, we were still making a living and stuff.
But not the
That did not happen. Not the own the big house in Marin.
Right. Know, none of that. Yeah.
So anyway, but he said I couldn't help when I read it. I couldn't help thinking, yes, it's gonna happen.
he was really gunning for you, man. He was gunning for you then.
So that was. That's a good book.
It is a great book.
Yeah, that, but it also chronicled kind of the beginning of the end of the band.
Right.
Our arc was hippie band in Ann Arbor, late 60s. Yes, you know, I went out to California first. George went out to teach art in Oshkosh. Went and got his doctorate. He got a University of Michigan doctorate, but he got it at Georgia Tech.
So you guys kind of splintered before the
California. Oh, yeah, yeah. We broke up. But I went to California, and I started hanging out there. That's what I wanted to do. I call it the Go West Young Man.
Right.
So, and I met a bunch of people, and I got to thinking we would be great out here. And one of the people, some of the people I met were called the Cleanliness and Godliness Skiffle.
Oh, that's Phil
Marsh.
Yeah, Phil Marsh's band.
Our good buddy Phil Marsh. I'm still tight with Phil today.
Same
you know?
Here, yeah. Talk to him all the time.
I don't mind saying. And so he... So those guys had kind of a wacky thing. They played a lot of old country and rock and roll, and were you know, and they had that jug band, you know,
the jug band
vibe that I loved.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
Anyway, I called them up, and I said, "You guys got to get out here, man. We can do something out here." And I said, "Plus, you think I'm lying? But if we play outdoors in the park." Girls take their clothes off.
This is Provo Park.
Well, wherever.
Yeah. So, Golden Gate, wherever.
So it was back then. Yeah.
I have pictures of you guys out in Provo
Park. That's right, Provo Park. Yeah. So anyway, they did. And Chris paid George had enough credit to buy a van on time, which ended up. We woke up one morning in Rock Ridge and there was no van. We had to go down to Bank of America to get our equipment out of it.
Oh, no.
Never saw the van again, but it was a glorious paint job with a keyboard ribbon of highway and semis and smoke seat down.
See, that was the mistake. You never want to put the keyboard on the side of a van.
I never even
That's free advertising for a break-in.
You put radioactive waste
right.
But anyway, so... I don't know where I was going with that. But anyway, they did join me in California.
So now, was that the entire band? Or
well, it was. Let me see who came out. I think Andy might have come out later. He might have had obligations at music school. But it was the Creeper, who was the first steel player, who had been playing. Oh, no, I forgot about the West Virginia Creeper. He had been playing with George and Tishy, I think, playing bass in fret rock bands already. He was a gymnast at the for University of Michigan. A cheerleader, kind of a gymnast. Anyway, he learned steel guitar, and he was the first. And he actually influenced a bunch of people because back then there was really no hippie steel players,
right?
Outside of a few in LA, were like, you know. But the
were sort of one of the first kind of country influences.
I would say. I think we're pretty much.
Before the Dead and people like that?
Maybe not before, but more
time,
more committed to that stuff.
Right,
it wasn't just a thing.
Before
and I think,
new writers and people
Yeah,
like
well,
that.
Maybe not before, but around the same time.
Same time, yeah.
And yeah. I don't know the exact dates, but down there, and we certainly were playing Bob Wills, for instance.
Right.
But when nobody
right.
was.
Nobody
we were also
was
playing Rockabilly.
Right,
really
you sure
that.
Were, yeah.
So we were kind of wild and woolly. We weren't as sort of careful and you know nice as we're trying to be bad boys.
You guys had an amazing show, man.
It's a good show.
Yeah, I saw you guys the first time at the San Bernardino Civic.
I'm gonna have a bite of scone.
The first time I saw it was at San Bernardino Civic in like I want to say 1971 maybe.
What was the bill?
You know that I don't remember. I just remember you guys. I don't even remember who the other band was. It was some hard rock band, but it was like you're the ones I remember.
Cool.
Yeah,
that was great times. I mean, we also were early adapters to the world of having a bus. We bought a 54 Greyhound Super Scenic, which is the kind of bus that's got.
Was that the one from Lamont Cranston?
No, it wasn't from Lamont.
Who did you buy it from?
It was from a company in Nashville. I don't know. Oh, okay. Lamont Trask.
Okay. Maybe they bought yours or something. I don't know.
Somebody. No, Hoyt Axton bought
it. Okay. Hoyt Axton was the one that bought it. Yeah. Okay.
But
it's
got a snout and then it comes back. Then there's a second windshield and it goes back. And so we had 12. Some friends of ours took it to a hippie alternative high school and they built an interior, which was just wonderful. They used old scavenged wood from old oak. Shipping pallets.
Oh, cool.
12 bunks, a lower lounge, which had this great table that you could kind of slide around where we played cards and drank beer, and then an upper lounge that held about 6 people, and they smoked and listened to jazz.
As I recall, 12 bunks you told me a great story about one time the bus braking on a mountain or something.
Oh, we all had to push.
And you guys had to push the
bus. Look at those 12 of us. Might have been the Donner Pass.
What a story, man. I mean, you know, that's the funny thing is I remember a lot of your stories from 30 years ago. Seriously, 40 years
ago. Well, I look at those as our riches today.
They really are.
Rich in stories.
Oh, yeah. You had some great stories. You had another one about being in Winnemucca and having to leave the van or something.
Oh, yeah. That was with
the moonlight.
Yeah, that was the moonlight. It was actually a bus. We had a...
Right.
Hello. Thank you. We had a, I did a tour with them. I started a band called the Moonlighters, and it was like a 7-piece.
Right.
We started out moonlighting from Cody.
Right.
And we actually, our first gig was backing up Lily Tomlin.
Wow.
Because Lily had just been in the movie Nashville.
Right.
Big movie. And she created a character I don't think exists in the movie. It was called Wanda B. Wilford. And so we were her band.
That might have been in the movie.
Well, maybe so. Maybe that's the character name in the movie. Yeah. But at any rate, she was that character. So I never met Lily. I met Wanda Wilford. I never met her. But she did open for, we played a week at the boarding house. That's what it was. Just a one-shot deal. She was great. And
now, did you know Ronnie Blakely?
We did.
Yeah.
And the reason I knew Ronnie was because she sang with Hoyt Axton.
Right. I remember she was with Hoyt. Yeah.
I ran into her not that long ago, a few years ago.
Right.
And Renee Armand was also in. It was Ronnie and Renee Armand, two tremendous singers.
Right.
Gals.
Right.
And, Renee married, not Jim Holmes. Anyway, we don't care.
So one thing I wanted, before we get into the Moonlighters, I wanted to just kind of get into the whole story of Cody and how you guys were this hippie band in San Francisco. And eventually, as I recall, I know John Nicholas was telling me, you were the ones that talked to Sleep at the Wheel to come along.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you know those guys, though? Was it Nicholas?
We knew them because when we were still in Ann Arbor, or maybe we used to come back to Ann Arbor. We used to drive back. I remember I bought my then girlfriend, now wife, still wife, Louise. I'd seen she needed a car or something, or else I didn't have the money and she did, but she bought a 1950 Kaiser Vagabond off the co-op Bolton.
Whatever the hell that is.
Well, the Vagabond, it's like half the trunk lid folded down and the rest of it folded up and the back seat, folded down. It was like a station wagon, but looked like a sedan, it looked like a big old 1950 Plymouth or something.
Wow, okay.
A short-lived Kaiser Fraser company. But anyway, so we drove that, for instance. Me and Louise and Lance drove that all the way out to California.
Right.
I mean, from California to Ann Arbor. So we did that a lot. But at one point, I've completely lost the thread here. What am I talking about?
Oh, we're talking about Cody. Cody and Sleep at the Wheel.
So we're back probably before we left, but Ray Benson and I believe Ann Lucky Oceans were at Yellow Springs, Ohio, going to Antioch.
Oh, okay.
And we got invited down to play a show there. This would have been the 60s. And it was the Wheel, the Young Wheel, I believe. I don't know if they were called that or not, but there was, or maybe they didn't even have a band. I don't remember the details. There was a band on the bill called Ed Chicken and the French Fries. Those were the days. And this is in Yellow Springs, which also was a nexus of hippiedom and liberal.
Now, is that where Yorma has his?
It's not too far away. Yeah. That's Yellow Springs. Yorma's near Athens, Ohio.
Okay.
So we went down there and met those guys. And then later on, they ended up in D.C. They bought a house in Paw Paw, West Virginia. They didn't buy one. They just rented one.
Really?
Yeah. And they invited us to play at the emergency. We got it. How did this work? We're living in California.
Right.
And we go to D.C. and we play. We were supposed to play a normal, you know, a marijuana legalization operation benefit on the mall, like in 68 or 69 or something. Right. Whether we did or not, I don't remember, but we did play at the emergency with Sleep at the Wheel. That was a neat, a guy named Michael Schreibman.
They called the Wheel at this point?
Yeah, they were Sleep at the Wheel. And then we went to their house and we stayed with them in Paw Paw, which was this very, very primitive conditions. I think there was like a hole in the floor, so the heat would come up to the second floor. And we ate venison that had been killed, but it had been killed with a pickup truck and a ball peen hammer. If that doesn't put you off meat, nothing else.
It'll make you a vegetarian.
Just stick with the potatoes. And Chris O'Connell was living there.
Oh, really?
She's his girlfriend. She's in Alameda,
Right.
But she was not even singing with the band, as I recall, yet.
Now, was Nicholas in there?
No, Nicholas was not. Nicholas was joined them in, not even in, I don't even think he joined them in California. I think he joined them when they moved to Texas. Okay. We also brought...
Well, no, he lived in California.
I know he did. We helped bring the Boogie Brothers out, too.
Oh, okay.
Which is Johnny and Steve.
Yeah, with Franny Steve? And...
Franny and Sarah. Brown. Yeah, right. And Johnny, and maybe Steve Nardella. Right. So we kind of helped them come out. We helped... I know we helped the Wheel come out, because Louise and I had been living in a chicken coop behind this like big cooperative house we had. And when they, a bedroom in the house opened up, we went in there and a couple of the Wheel ended up in the chicken coop. But it was idyllic.
Boy, things were funky when you were young.
It was California, so there was nonstop. Yeah, yeah. One of the guys worked at the local brewery, so there was all just, you know, cases of beer. But it was a nonstop volleyball game in the backyard, and there was trees. This is right by the DMV in Oakland.
Right, you know, I know right where you're going. Yes, I know right where that is.
And it was great. They raised it to make a parking lot. It was the last place the creek in Oakland was above ground.
And right.
All the houses had, you know, no paint left on them. They're just waiting to be
demolished.
Yeah. And it was really cool.
Now, did you meet Carol Perry at that point?
I met Carol really early on in Berkeley. And Louise had already met him. And, and I loved Carol. I know you became real close to him.
We were really good friends.
So good. I love that guy. And
I think I may have heard about you prior to meeting him.
But you, Carol,
I think
maybe,
so. Carol told me he knew all you did.
He was just one of those guys you met, and you go, this is a great guy.
Yeah.
And he actually, my daughter got to meet him before he died, which is somehow in my mind, that's a great thing that she got to see this guy.
That is great, yeah.
So I went out, I was on Berkeley on my own, and I was playing some with, I'd play some with Miles Sanka, the guy who would.
But you were with Louise at this point?
No, I met her after the Cody Man moved out. I wasn't with Louise in the 60s. I met her, we don't even know when we met, we can't remember, probably 72,
but you
71.
Both came from Manhattan?
No. Louise is from Cupertino. She moved out. She was going to UC Berkeley.
Right.
She's a couple of years
ahead.
And
I think Carol said he had something to do with you guys meeting, as I recall. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
I don't think so, but I'm not going to argue with Carol Perry through the grave.
Yeah.
And certainly we both knew him, that may have helped us get to know each other. But I met her at a party.
Okay.
And then we were playing a party for a guy who just turned 21 or something.
Right.
And she was his girl. They were a couple at that time. And that didn't last, but I don't know.
Right.
We did.
So basically, you guys stayed in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
From then on.
Till 86. Yeah. Right. I got there in 60. I was there 68 to 86. And I started in San Francisco and working at a motorcycle messenger. As a matter of fact, one of the other messengers, we drive our bikes around with canvas bags full of blueprints around the financial district.
Right.
And one of the other guys who drove was had a Telecaster and I had an SG. We just swapped and I got my Tele.
Really?
I played it every day for the next 45 years.
Well, too much. So that's how you became a Tele guy.
That's how I wanted one, and that's how I did. I've been listening to Merle Haggard with Glenn Nichols and Buck Owens with Don Rich.
Right.
They both played Tele.
I could hear that.
Yeah. I went,
I hear a lot of Roy Nichols in your playing.
I wish, you know, I idolize.
Yeah. So, so basically, in the Cody band, that was kind of what really put you on the path of more like country, truck driving music, and rockabilly, and all of it.
I discovered that. I really haven't listened to much.
Which kind of became your signature.
That's right. And I owe it those guys for turning me on to that stuff. Absolutely.
Right.
They turned me on to Western Swing, which I knew nothing about. Never even, matter of fact, I don't know that I really had ever figured out what country music was, if you can imagine that. Because even though it was on the charts, it was on the same radio stations, but I really didn't listen to much pop radio. I was like a folky, you know, I was just a kid. And I remember...
Right.
The only records I heard back then were, well, I mean, I also saw Ricky Nelson on my next door neighbor's TV. We didn't have a TV. So, you know, I kind of knew that stuff a little bit, but not really. And I didn't really pay attention to pop music until the Beatles.
Okay.
That got through to me when I was a junior in high school.
So the Beatles and eventually
Dylan. And then Dylan right away. I got into Dylan right away, right off the bat, as soon as he showed up. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he played my high. I saw him in 64 twice, once at Newport, I mentioned before, and once at our high school. Ann Arbor was a stop on the way. Man. Ann Arbor was like...
That's amazing.
I climbed up into the light deck. I'd been in a theater group there earlier, junior theater, plays for kids. And I climbed up into the light booth and I'm the light deck over the stage where you set the lights on. I just watched him from right up there. He's like, whoa.
Incredible.
So, yeah. But
did people know who he was at that point?
They did, but he wasn't. It was an auditorium at Ann Arbor High that wasn't that big. I mean, there probably was, it could well have been a couple hundred people there.
We were talking about the Moonlighters and how it got off. We were talking about Tony Johnson, the drummer. And how did you meet Austin? Austin DeBone.
Well, actually, I had met Austin when I first came to California. When the original Cody band had broken up, I went to the Freight and Salvage, which was a little joint on San Pablo.
Right.
And Austin DeBone, I remember once, I'd met Audie later, and I was talking to him, and I said, oh, yeah, the first time I went to the Freight and Salvage, I really liked all the folk singers, but every now and then something wild would happen. He said, I was there once, and there was a bunch of guys on stage, and they were doing James Brown's song, The Camel Walk. And they were singing songs like, Born Under an Onion, Smelled Bad, since I began to come home. Wasn't for bad breath, wouldn't have no breath at all. Stuff like this. Born Under an Onion. So, and other weirder songs. And I said, yeah, I remember these guys. They're playing The Camel Walk by James Brown. You know, and then they started walking around the audience like this. And Audie goes, that was me.
Oh, that's great. So you didn't even know it was him.
No, I didn't even know
it was him. That's friggin' great.
But he was around Mill Valley. I used to see his band Eggs Over Easy. They're great. And they'd been to England. Audie also. So anyway, he'd been to England with his band Eggs Over Easy. And Chaz Chandler had managed them.
Wow.
And John Steele, the drummer from the Animals, right when the Animals broke up, Chaz managed, he also, of course, managed Jimi Hendrix.
Imagine that you had probably a decent following in Austin as well from Cody.
Yeah, I did. It's funny because when I first moved here, I had a real good following. As a matter of fact, it was kind of embarrassing. We've been what we then seemed so long ago, which was 30, back then that was only 30 years prior. We made Deep in the Heart of Texas.
Right.
But people would go down the street and go, Bill Kirchen I couldn't really buy a gig. Interesting. There was a big dichotomy.
So people knew who you were, but it was
my legend loomed large, but my gig.
Your legend didn't quite seep over into the venue owners, I guess.
And the other problem was, it was at that point one of the least paying. It was a great music center for the audience, but it was not any kind of a pay scale that I was used to. So I had to completely change my mind about what I play for. It was, it's a college town, and also it's
very much based on tips.
Yes, it was a tip town, and it's a magnet for musicians with no industry. It wasn't like Chicago has that whole, you know, Jingles Market and Nashville and, you know, all the recording in New York and LA. Austin, nothing.
Zip.
Yeah, so. But I don't mean that, but a great supportive town. But everybody here learned you make your money on the road.
Right.
That's how it works. Right. And I had really, I would be like 50-50 back in D.C. It was such a
So in a way, market. I mean, the way I look at Austin is it's a good kind of jump off point to go on the road, because you can basically hit the West Coast from the same, you know, distance, mileage, and same thing with the East Coast, same thing with the Midwest. It's
and
a good start.
And it's a community of musicians.
And later, it is a community.
Later, I really got enmeshed in that community better. So I don't blame I don't blame Austin for nothing. But I did at one point move back to D.C. and
kind of out of frustration somewhat.
And frustration is too strong a word, but just thinking, well, I can make some money back
right.
here. I better do that. Well, I liked it here always. I never didn't like it.
Right.
And eventually I came back, and the catalyst there was my daughter had joined us, and she started a family. So all of a sudden I had one granddaughter, then two granddaughters, and a son-in-law.
Right.
And that was the carrot to bring us back. And by then, I integrated better in it. I also had, I was able to, I had more touring places. I had more I could do for some reason. My career, if you want to call that. I know I have a job. I'm not sure if I have a career, but, you know. But I was able to sustain us very, very nicely by traveling. And then at home, enjoy the fruits of this great music.
So now, do you have a regular band that you travel with, or do you kind of do it?
Well, I have a regular band that I travel with, but for the first time in my life, I'm not using them for all the gigs, which I still feel guilty about.
Yeah.
But that's just the economic realities. And they understand, too, and they probably don't want to do all the stuff I'm doing.
Yeah, that's kind of how I am. I don't have a band per se, but I have favorite guys that I use all the time.
I have my local guys that I use all the time. Right. They're great. That's Rick Richards on drums.
And right.
He actually, the last big gig he had, well, he was with Ray Wiley Hubbard, and that begat a gig for several years with Joe Walsh.
Wow.
So he's been to the big shows.
Wow.
You know,
and, yeah, he's done
and,
a big
and
stuff.
And Jack Saunders, the bass player, Saunders, they've both been playing together for 40 years in Houston.
Wow.
And, and
so
he's
got a
also,
built-in thing
oh,
going
yeah.
On.
Oh, they got a thing, and they're great guys. Both of them great guys, great players, great, you know, great singers. So I'm just a lucky guy. And I do want to find a way to take them to California. I did it, I don't know which exact band. I did it once with Rick, but not with Jack. And when he wasn't in the band yet. So anyway.
So when you go to California, do you usually
Paul
use
Ravelli
guys up
and Bruce Butler?
Yeah. Okay. So
and
you use Audie those
Loader,
guys
Bobby
up
Lapp. That's what I've been doing for a
while. Okay. So yeah, you're
great.
Kind of doing
they're
it like that.
Yeah.
That makes sense to do that. That's the way, you know, I mean, the way I look at it, I mean, do you book yourself? Is that right?
Yeah, but for instance, I just got back from the longest tour I've ever done in my
life.
Right,
you told me. You went around the world.
Around the world, and then I went back to Europe. I went around the world west, and then I went back east to Europe and toured Europe. And then me and those two guys got in the van and did a whole band tour from Texas all the way up to Canada.
Oh, you know, my God. And you're how old?
I thought I was 55. It turns out I'm 120. I'm 75. I'm going to be 76.
Boy, oh boy. Man.
Yeah, I did it. Part of it was like,
I can do it.
Watch this, kids, you know.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to show them.
Here,
that's my
here
energy.
Hold my cappuccino. But it was fun. And I started out, that was a duet show. And I went to actually with Red Volker to Australia and played with the Australian rhythm section for 10 days. And I flew from Australia to London, which is 24 hours.
Oh, my God.
You have to stop. I stopped in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
But anyway, blah, blah, blah. So we did all that. So I travel, but
I thought Hong Kong is 24 hours.
No, not well. From here, it probably is.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just Melbourne to Hong Kong.
Oh, okay.
Not that far. And then Hong Kong to London was a lot.
Boy,
it added to 24.
Man,
then we drove to Holland and played. It used to be the Blue Highways Festival.
So that those all did well.
Yeah, we did well. So I do odd things like that with playing with. I just got off the road with Robbie Fulks, and I'll do another 3 days with him in July.
Cool.
So I enjoy that. But I love playing with my band, too, I got to say.
Yeah, I love the idea of doing different things with different people. I really enjoy that a lot. Now, tell me a little bit before we go.
You and me, baby. I'm here for you. I'll just do that all night.
My shuffle king.
I'll do it.
So tell me a little bit about Nick Lowe and how you got, I mean, you became part of that band for a minute, right?
What happened was I went to England, met Nick, I played, we opened, the Moonlighters opened for him at the Sportatorium in L.A. somehow.
Right.
We came back from making a record with him, and who else was in that? Somebody else involved. What's the band? The Alvin Brothers. I'm blanking on the band.
Oh, the Blasters.
The Blasters, yeah. The Blasters. So I met Nick there, and then I'm over in England, and I met the guys who became my record label. Malcolm Mills had a record called Proper Records, and I made the next four records on Proper in English.
Okay.
And he became a... He was just a great guy. I'm still in touch with him. I still play with him. Now he plays drums with us. We managed to get back on the drums.
Wow.
As a drummer, but wow. Been in the record business. He had Proper Records for 33 and a third years.
Damn.
So now he's at the Last Music Company, and I'm on that with some records. And he said he gave me a record deal, and I talked to Jake, and Jake said, let's make a record with the same exact band you toured the world with. I made a record with Nick called The Impossible Bird.
Right, that I remember.
And that was all Englishmen except me. I was.
And you had Geraint Watkins.
Geraint Watkins on piano, right. Bobby Irwin on drums, the late Bobby Irwin on drums, Paul, bassman Riley played bass, and Nick Lowe fronted it, played guitar. So we made that, and then we toured the world. That was The Impossible Bird's tour. We toured everywhere, you know, all over Europe, Japan, and all over the States with Nick.
Wow.
And that was interesting because that was him starting a whole second phase of his career. He was writing songs that weren't as, like, you know, wild and woolly. And
right.
He was very specifically trying to not act like a teenager.
Right. And he was kind of almost doing country-ish.
Yeah,
kind of folkish. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great songs.
Great
too.
Stuff, yeah.
Really great songs.
And even remember, one of the albums is called "At My Age," so you know he's addressing that stuff in a way. I don't call it reinventing himself; I call it more just. I was talking to Robbie about this. We were with Robbie Fultz, and he was saying, "Yeah, it's more like he acknowledged himself, you know, who he was at this point." So that was great doing that. And so, when I got a deal, Nick's manager Jake Rivera suggested that I make a record using those same guys. This time, Nick switched to bass. And Paul Bassman Riley produced the record.
Interesting.
And so that was the record. That was that record. That's
called. Is Geraint Watkins on it?
Yeah, Geraint Watkins and Audie DeLone. I brought Audie DeLone.
Wow.
So those two guys.
Right.
Me on guitar, Bobby Irwin on drums, Mick Lowe on bass, and that's called "Hammer the Honky Tonk Gods."
Oh, okay.
And that's the first record I made in this whole period of my life. Now I made three more records with that bunch. A fourth record with Audie called "Transatlantic Cannon."
Wow.
And then a fifth record just came out, which is a compilation of the first three albums with a truck.
How cool.
The track, I mean, not a truck.
And now, are you on the album with him, the album with Heartbreaker, I think it's called?
Nick, the album, the song I'm on the album. I don't know about Heartbreaker. That album has got Soulful Wind. It's got 12-Step Program. It's got True Love Travels on a Gravel Road.
That's the live album, right?
No, this is the album I made with Nick.
Okay.
This is the album. Are you talking about my album or Nick's album?
Yeah.
Well, it's called The Impossible Bird, and it's got...
I have that.
It's got... Oh, there's another record called Party of One that I recorded with Nick before that in L.A.
Okay.
His last major label record. I did that.
Yeah.
And that was on... I'm on all the tracks. But that was produced by Dave Edmunds, his prior... You know, part of the rock.
Well, I'll have to look it up. I have the album.
Heart is the great song.
The one I'm thinking is called Heartbreaker, and it starts with like a organ. I think that's what it's called. Yeah, I'll look it up. I'll find it. Anyway, what do you got coming up, man, besides another world tour? Let's hope so.
Sure.
Right?
I'm going back to England to play the Americana Festival in England.
Cool.
I'll be there in July 4th in London.
What's your website?
BillKirchner.com.
Easy enough.
We just made a new album that came out on Malcolm's label, the last music company, called Back from the Ozone. And what that is, I use this as a little coda to our interview.
Right.
That was the available surviving Lost Plains Airmen, the five of us I mentioned earlier. Billy C is incognito somewhere, we can't find him. And of course, Lance is gone. So those of the seven airmen, those two weren't available.
Right.
The rest of us made this record with Pete Siegel, Paul Rebelli, and Austin DeLone, those three people.
So Bill Black couldn't be on.
Bobby Black's on it, but he only played on a couple songs because he wasn't really in good health. So, and we're going to actually be playing with that same group in California, if this comes out before then, at the end of June 28th and 29th.
Yeah, this will be out before.
Yeah, and the Freight and Salvage and the Hot Monk and the Bottle both.
Cool.
I believe Hot Monk first on the 28th, and on my birthday, my 76th birthday, trombone. That's my trombone.
What's the date again?
June 29th at the Freight.
I'll be around.
June 28th, you come down.
I'll be around. I'll come down.
You can play the harp on something.
You bet. I'll be glad to.
All right.
Yeah.
And anyway, but the album was fun because we went into the studio and we decided we couldn't just do try to redo the Cody stuff. So we redid, of the 12 cuts, we redid six of the cuts that weren't. One of them actually we probably never recorded, Ain't Nothing Shaking, a Dallas Frazier song, but we've done it a lot. And we did stuff that wasn't as big, you know, like the Gene Vincent doo-wop number, Get It, Wind Your Stuff and Back to Tennessee.
That's one story I do want you to tell. The Gene Vincent.
Okay.
That's such a great story. You brought him out as a special guest with Cody, right?
Okay, here's what happened.
Yeah. This is a great story.
He had been to England, right. not the time where his buddy Eddie Cochran died and he got hurt. But he'd been, and he'd come back, and he wasn't.
Was he in the cab, by the way?
Yeah, I think he was
in the cab when Eddie Cochran
So he always kind of made a big deal about his leg. He kind of dragged it around on stage. But you know, Gene Vincent was so good. Anyway, so he had just made a record. Some people together with a record. I don't think it was the most sensible thing for him to do, but it was. They wanted to make a hippie record with him. Now, I don't think Gene Vincent was a hippie. I was a hippie. And I like Gene Vincent, but
that's great.
But he had this song that went raspberry, strawberry, chocolate, vanilla. You be my dinner, I'll be your fella. Red, blue, strawberry, green, or something. It's like, oh man. And the other one was called Busted. Possession of Love and a Pocket Knife. Now, I'm kind of making fun of it, but anyway, he's still the great Gene Vincent. And there's some live cuts of us backing him up.
And
it wasn't really,
it wasn't that great.
I mean, it wasn't.
Yeah.
He would just stop changing songs in the middle and stuff. And,
oh my God.
But, so we did one big, he came and he rehearsed with us in the basement of that place where I told you I lived in the chicken coop. I might've been still in
Berkeley. Yeah.
And it was a dirt floor basement with like pallets on the ground. We rehearsed down there.
Right.
And, Gene was great, man. He just loved playing with us. We did a bunch of his songs. I kind of worked out the lead to Bebop a little. And he wouldn't. We said, "Do Woman Love." And he goes, "Nope, I can't do it. No rust." You wish, kind of. He just had an unrealistic view of what was going on.
Right.
He said something like, something that could have been construed as the F-bomb. So anyway, he wouldn't do that, but that's fine. And then he was doing Crazy Arms. We said, you ought to sing Crazy Arms and do that. Grace says, nope, I can't sing that because I always mix up the first two words. So, you know, he
Arms
he,
crazy?
Blue, no, not the first two, sorry. Blue ain't the word for the way that I feel. But he said, I usually sing blue ain't the way for the word that I feel. So we get to the gig. Sure enough, it's the first song on the set. Sure enough, he does that. When he does that, he kind of flinches. It was in the Oakland Coliseum.
Oh,
opening,
wow.
You know, opening for Merle Haggard.
Wow.
And
incredible.
And I know. There's Austin, Gene Vincent, and Merle Haggard. And Merle Haggard was at his fight inside of me.
Oh yeah,
which was sort of divisive at that time.
And he was pretty great at that point.
He was great the whole time. I'm a huge Haggard fan.
Same here.
I get to play with Red Volker, who played with about 4 years.
Wow! Was he really young at the time?
Well, he wasn't that young. No, he looked just as old as he does today.
There was some guy that used to play in the band that had a
No, that's not him.
Really young, but he lives around here.
Red lives here, but he, you know, I don't know who you're thinking of, but yeah. Red lives here and he looks like Shrek.
Okay.
Well, he's a Canadian, but he looks like a Viking. You know, he's got a
great beard. So anyway,
Red is one of people ask me who's better than Danny Gatton or Red. I go, how would I know? They're both just ungodly great.
Well, continue.
This was Murrow with the original band, with Roy Nichols and Norm Hamlet and all the guys. And so Gene gets up there and does that, you know, kind of flinches, and it's the Diamond Vision screens. They're like these 40 foot screens where you can see everything.
Yeah.
And I had just a couple of years before seen the Johnny Cash show with Carl Perkins when I first watched in 69. But anyway, that's a sidetrack. So we did that and we opened for Merle. And then we played, earlier than that, we played the Long Branch in town.
Right.
The day before we played the Long Branch.
Right.
And we had all gotten dosed on PCP.
The guy passed
around a whiskey bottle laced with this. God knows what PCP was.
And Gene Vincent too?
Gene Vincent left before the whiskey bottle came out. We did the second set, and I remember Billy C went from the stage flat unconscious on the floor and went to the hospital,
God.
So he missed the show with Gene.
And
I was put out, I had been trying to stick my, I stepped in my cord. Billy C had been preaching, he'd been on stage going, Rob went to hell in the morning. And we were doing Pope Saladini, and I was trying.
I was trying to
plug my
your cable in,
but I was touching into the pickup. They said I wasn't really. I was unclear of the concept. I remember they put me in a car sitting out front, this ratty old car. I remember thinking in San Pablo, cars would drive by, and I look at the Long Branch and go, maybe it was the Babylon back there. Was I in a band that was on that stage? I mean, complete erasure of personality. And then I heard traffic going by. I says, well, the way the traffic's going by, I think there must have been a nuclear war down there. I mean, and they dropped me off at Louisa's house. We were just dating at the time. And they dropped me off there. And I, every five minutes, go, what's going on? You get those. So anyway, those are rough times.
Lance told me the thing about him dragging his leg around or something.
Yeah, he would drag his leg around
on
kind
stage
of make a deal
and
over,
try
yeah.
to make try to make it part of the show or something.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, he did. And he was the great Gene Vincent, so I can dig it. He did get hurt in a traffic accident.
Yeah, I know.
Killed Eddie Cochran. You know,
right.
So.
That's incredible.
And that was in Wales.
Well, anyway, it was great, Bill. Love talking to you.